My name is Hugh Kerr. I'm the former member of the European Parliament for Essex West and Hertfordshire East. I spent a lifetime in the Labour Party until I was expelled by Tony Blair in 1998 for opposing his policies on almost everything. I came back to Scotland in 1999 and helped to found the Scottish Socialist Party along with Tommy Sheridan, became its first chair, its first press officer. And that indeed is when I met Alex Salmond for the first time. In the European elections, of course, of that period, which I was number one on the list for the SSP. And Alec, I always remember him at the count. He said, "Who is this bloody de Hont fellow who invented this system?" Because he was very near to getting two MSPs instead of one. One, of course, the existing one was Winnie Ewing, who was a good friend of mine. Winnie was the mother of Scottish nationalism and independence. Alex undoubtedly is the current father and, of course, sadly deceased father of Scottish independence and the SNP. So Winnie was a good friend of mine at Strasbourg and Brussels. Many a glass of bubbles we had together. And she invited me to join the SNP when I was expelled from the Labour Party by Tony Blair. But I said, "Look, Winnie, I'm a socialist." She said, "But we've got socialists in the SNP, Hugh." I said, "Yeah, you've also got liberals, Tories, and people with no politics at all." So I said, "Leave it with me." I said, "We will work together when I come back to Scotland." And we did. Winnie and I used to meet regularly, and Alec and I met regularly, discussing the years of how the left and the SNP could work together. So that's when I met Alec, first of all. I've known him for about 30 years now. And very sad, of course, about his loss, as we all are. And of course, I was a member of the ALBA party, which Alec founded when he got a broke with the SNP when they tried.
But before we run too far forward, sure. Can you say something about this whole business of devolution and Blair? Because right. We can look back on this as a sort of poison chalice that Blair was emptying and there, almost offering the Scots something which was going to cause division. But ultimately, of course, it came to nothing with the referendum. But so how did that all happen?
Well, of course, there's a long history behind it, like 300 years. Scotland was a nation for 900 years before it was bought over and forced to join the Act of Union in 1707. In fact, Winnie Ewing wonderfully reopened the Scottish Parliament by saying, "The Scottish Parliament will now reopen after its interruption." Its interruption was 293 years, but in 1707, it was forced to join with the European, with the union with England, because they had an army at the borders. They threatened to cut off all foreign trade, and only about 10% of the population of Scotland had a vote in 1707. The bourgeoisie essentially were represented in the Scottish Parliament, and they were bought over by English gold, as Robert Burns recalls in his famous song. So there's a long history, of course, of people pushing for independence and of what happened towards the last 20 or 30 years before the setting up of the Scottish Parliament, as people began to see devolution, limited power Scottish Parliament is the answer to quell this uprising. In fact, even the Tories were in favour of it originally under Thatcher. She promised it. And then Labour under Donald Dewar in particular was very keen on it. And of course, they hoped that this would quell the rise of the SNP. In fact, George Robertson went on to be General Secretary of NATO, said, "The devolution of Scotland will kill the SNP stone dead." Well, I met him a few years after. So I said, "Well, that didn't work, George, did it?" And they said, "No, that was a slight mistake." Because, of course, what it did was to allow the SNP to flourish in a parliament and eventually win a majority in it, which convinced people that actually they were competent running the country, and therefore independence, well, that might not be a step too far.
No, okay. So can you say something about Alex Rye's, because the SNP did it do extremely well under his tutelorship, didn't it?
It did extremely well. Alex succeeded the old guard of the SNP, Billy Wolfe and Gordon Wilson, in I think about 89. And his first step, there was only three MPs from the SNP in the House of Commons. And he made a bit of an impact by interrupting the budget, getting himself thrown out. In other words, he went down there to create a fuss for Scotland, not to settle in, sadly, as many of the more recent MPs have done. Including my own one, Tommy Shepherd, was an old Labour man from Hackney, who first speech said, we haven't come here to upset the apple cart, which is, of course, what they should have done. So Alec began to make an impression there, and an importance, of course, in Scotland began to develop the SNP into a much more well-organised party, which began to make an impact. And so then the first Scottish Parliament, they, I think, elected about 26 MSPs, and then later on, 2007, got more, and then 2011 achieved a majority, which, of course, the system under de Hont of the additional list system is really meant to prevent any one party getting a majority. That Alec managed in 2011, the only leader of a party who's ever managed to do that in the 25 years of the Scottish Parliament. So Alec was a giant amongst, to be frank, pygmies in the Scottish Parliament. I mean, in the old days, there were some people like Donald Dewar, of course, and Jack McConnell, who had been around for a time. But Alec was head and shoulders above them all. In fact, he was, you know, him, Tommy Sheridan, Alex Neil, John McCallion. There were three or four really great speakers in the first Scottish Parliament. I mean, and Alec was one of those.
There's a sort of irony, isn't there, about the 2014 independence referendum, because this was always the great goal of the SNP, and yet the people didn't want it, and there was a vote against it, and that actually precipitated the resignation of Alex and the rise of this lady called Nicola Sturgeon. So there was something very ironic about that, first of all, that but also maybe you could say something about this relationship with Sturgeon.
Yes, well, let me first of all correct you about the referendum. Firstly, of course, Alec got the referendum because in 2011 he won a majority of seats in the Scottish Parliament, and that convinced David Cameron, who was the Prime Minister at the time, the Tory, on the radio this morning, it convinced Cameron that he was entitled, therefore, to have a referendum in Scotland. Now, at that time, the support for independence for Scotland was running about 28% in Scotland. So Cameron thought, this will be a doddle. It'll get wiped away and it'll be swept away for a generation. Now, what happened, of course, is that the support went up from 28% finally to 45%. But crucially, and this is the point people in England should understand, Tony, the majority of Scots who were born in Scotland voted for independence in 2014. The majority against was made up of a substantial number of English people who had moved to Scotland, cheaper property and all that, and the European citizens who were entitled to vote in the Scottish referendum, because Westminster allowed them to vote, because they were deemed to be voting on local issues, and the EU regulations, and I know I helped to draft them, allowed you to vote in local government, whatever country you were in Europe, and therefore they were deemed to be able to vote in the Scottish Parliament elections in 2014. Now, the campaign against independence said to the EU citizens, if you vote for independence, you will be thrown out of the European Union. Ironically, 2 years later, they weren't allowed to vote on Brexit because they were told they weren't British citizens. And of course, they were thrown out of Europe because of Brexit. Similarly, the English people who've come to live in Scotland said, oh, we don't want to cut our ties to England. And what will happen to our pensions? Lots of lies and propaganda were used. But the key factor, and John Curtis, Professor John Curtis is the authority on this, will tell you, his research shows the majority of Scottish people who lived in Scotland, were born in Scotland, voted for independence in 2014. And crucially, in the demographics, it was the older people, pensioners 65 plus, who were against independence, the young under 35, heavily in favour of 35 to 55, more or less evenly split. So the history of the demographics is that Scotland will have a majority of independence over the next 10 years.
Well, whatever you say about the rights and wrongs of who was voting and who wasn't, I mean, surely Alec would have been crazy to take on that referendum with the possibility of losing it. And he must have thought about these things beforehand.
But he did, and he knew that with a good campaign, then we could win the victory, even though European citizens and English people were voting. You know, for example, in Denmark, you can't vote on constitutional questions unless you've been a Danish citizen for at least 10 years. So It was very unusual for this voting pattern. Alex thought he could win it. And of course, he got from 28% to 45%. In fact, there was a Sunday Times poll 3 weeks before the election, which had a majority in favour of independence. And at that point, they released a whole barrage of attacks from England, including, you know, threats by all the Royal Bank of Scotland, so that they would leave the country. And Gordon Brown and the Daily Record, which was the Labour Unionist paper, produced this great vow. It was called the vow, Gordon's vow, that there would be much more attention given to Scotland under devolution, that they'd be allowed to run their own affairs and so on, if they voted to stay. And that vow did shift a lot of people and said, oh, well. And also they threatened to take away Scotland's right to use the pound, which was a nonsense. So it's actually the Bank of England was founded by a Scotsman, and we were actually just as legitimately able to use it as well. So all of those scares worked the trick, and we lost them by 45 to 55%. So it was very close, and it could have been won. And Alex, I think, then decided that he had, you know, made a mistake, and therefore he should let the next generation take on. Interestingly, just before he died, he admits that was a mistake. He should not have stood down and not allowed certainly Nicola Sturgeon to take over, who then did nothing for independence for the last 10 years.
Can I just get one thing straight? Is it Alec or Alex?
Alex. Alexander. So it's Alex, A-L-E-X.
There's a lot of people called him Alec.
And, well, you know how Alec and Alex often get mixed up. His name is Alexander, and he's known as Alex in a shorthand way.
And what about his religious faith? There is some sort of hint that was quite an important factor.
It wasn't important. He was a member of the Church of Scotland, nominally a Christian. He didn't flout it a lot. In fact, he one of the last events I saw him was an Alba bun supper where he played the Reverend I Am Jolly, which is a great character in Scottish entertainment by Ricky Fulton, which is a send-up of a Scottish minister, and he did it really well. He was a very funny man, Alec, had a great sense of humour, great sense of laughter and joy. And he did this very well. Now, he wasn't deeply religious. He was might have been nominally a Christian, but a lot of people are, but it doesn't affect them terribly much.
Well, and also sometimes people don't flaunt their faith, do they? They keep it rather quiet, sure. You know. And,
absolutely.
Anyway, what about Sturgeon, this relationship? A fascinating relationship, because he seemed to completely trust her to take on the party that he'd built up.
That's right, and he admits that was a mistake too. Nicola had been a young SNP activist from Irvine, from my part of the world in Ayrshire, and she'd been groomed by Alec and mentored and helped. She was a lawyer. The truth is, she was not a very good lawyer. In fact, she got reported for various malfunctions as a lawyer and gave up to become a politician. Got elected on the list system in Glasgow initially, and then later on as an individual. Constituency MSP. So Nicola was and she had said that she might go for the leadership, but when Alec decided to come back from Westminster, he went down to Westminster for a time, and I talked to him about that, and he said, Hugh, it's going to take some time before we are ready for a majority in the Scottish Parliament, so I'm going to go down to Westminster for a time, perform there, and he did it very effectively. Nicola decided to stand, but as soon as Alec decided to stand, she stood down as his deputy, and so she took over. It was a mistake by Alec. He admitted that in the end. He said, I thought I could hand it on safely to the new generation, and that generation would carry us forward to independence. The truth is, Nicola was not terribly interested in independence. She was much more interested in other things, gender issues and all the rest of it, which have focused on Scotland in the past 10 years. The other thing is, she didn't have the strategic vision that Alec has, or had, rather, sadly, in terms of how to judge political movements, how to make moves, how to make shifts, and so on. She was also a control freak, that nothing happened in the Scottish government unless Nicola approved it, which meant a lot of things happened rather badly. And the truth is, the great success period of the SNP was under the first period of the SNP government, 2007 to 2014, when Alex stood down. The great achievements like abolishing student fees, abolishing prescription charges, all the good things of the SNP government all came in that first period. in the last 10 years that not many good things and a lot of incompetence has come out of the SNP.
Yeah, can you say something about those various differences that there now are, which devolution has achieved? It's almost as if the England and Wales have gone off in a actually quite a dark direction towards much more corporate commercialisation of the state institutions. What is it that Scotland has now still retains of its state apparatus and state support that England and Wales don't have anymore?
Well, Scotland is a naturally social democratic country. It's always had a tradition. In fact, in the 97 election, we removed all the Tory MPs from Scotland. But of course, 1955, there was a majority of Tory MPs elected in Scotland. So Scotland has changed in the past 50, 60 years and has become much more of a social democratic country. Not a socialist country yet, but a social democratic country. And therefore, the fact that the SNP administration were competent under Alec and removed tuition fees from higher education, which of course were being introduced in England, and made prescription charges free, removed, you know, car park charges from hospitals, kept the NHS free in access. All of those things were much more part of the Scottish norm. And you're right that under Labour, New Labour under Blair, and of course under the Tories, and now of course under Keir Starmer, England has gone in this very different direction. Now it's gone to become a sort of offshore capitalist free market regime of the European Union and attract investment on that basis. That is not Scotland's ethos. Scotland is very different. And that's where maybe people realise that actually we've focused a lot in Scandinavia in recent years, realised that Scotland could be more like, you know, Denmark or Sweden, a social democratic country with good quality of public services. So there is that schism. But the important division with Sturgeon is that she realised that Alec was still a threat and Alec wanted to come back and to lead the independence movement. So they conspired together, there's no doubt about it, to try and put Alec in prison. They dug up all these charges about sexual harassment and so on, which of course...
Hugh. I mean, politicians can't do that. That's the job of the police, surely.
You're joking. Politicians can do anything. There was a group involved in the SNP and the leadership there who actively attempted to get Alec put into prison. They generated these campaigns and they found people to come forward and say that they'd been sexually harassed. That case went to court, prosecution service took it to court, and there was a majority of women on the jury, 9 women and 6 men, and Alec was found innocent in all the counts. But because the coverage of the press, which was sensational for the prosecution evidence and rather minimal for the defence evidence, Alec's reputation was traduced. And there's undoubtedly the case that Nicola was involved in that. There is a legal case for damages against the Scottish government, which was going ahead under Alec, and the executives of his estate are going to continue that case. It's likely to come into focus within the next year or so. And I know the lawyer involved. He's the best lawyer in Scotland. It was Tommy Sheridan's lawyer who won his case against the News of the World. And he's very confident that the case will be won. And when it comes out, the evidence will be clear that there was indeed a conspiracy to put Alec in prison and by people right at the top of the SNP. And we know who they are. And many more people in Scotland know who they are. When that comes out, the SNP will be finished as a political force.
I mean, that's certainly one to keep an eye on. Seems to me that that Sturgeon and her friends have it seems incredible to almost torpedo this dream from you know, for, as you said, almost hundreds of years. It seems incredible that just one person and a group of conspirators could do something like
alleged,
that.
Alleged, indeed, yes. Well, it is possible. You know, you're in a small country, Scotland, of 5 million people. Everybody kens their feather in Scotland. In other words, knowledge gets around publicly. And I found it difficult to believe, but actually I saw the evidence that actually there were this group involved. And the problem is that when it went to court, the judge restricted access to all this information to the public. And Craig Murray got banged up for 4 months, because in his blog and his coverage of the trial, the judge thought that he had revealed sufficient that people might be able to identify the people involved. I think she was wrong, and Craig might well be appealing that judgment as well. But people knew what was going on. There was a group of people, and the charges were thrown out by a jury of 9 women and 6 men. I think the truth is that they had become accepted into running devolution and forgotten to take their eye off the ball of
independence. Well, I mean, it sounds almost medieval, Hugh, the idea that, you know, you've got some sort of powerful ruler who can just destroy their political opponents. I mean, Craig, for example, has done a great service to humanity. And in fact, he's still like an ambassador for Scotland around the world. To try and destroy people like this, I mean, it does sound a bit medieval.
It is indeed. It's evil, to be frank. And that's what was an evil attempt to put Alec away in prison and to put him out the way of the independence debate. I think the truth is that the people in charge of the SNP had gone more interested in running devolution. And as I say, Nicola's interests seemed to move on to the personal kind of agenda and things like gender identity and so on, rather than the big issues of independence. Now, certainly in terms of Craig's case, he still has an eye on coming back and being in the Scottish Parliament. And I always joke with him, he'll be our first foreign minister when we're independent, because there couldn't be anybody better. That's, of course, if he survives any of his little excursions abroad at the moment.
Well, I know. But look, there's also Alex RT programme. And also his vehement support for the Palestinians. These things have all made him really, MI6 and the London establishment really didn't like this guy. I mean, it's almost like that they wish he would just, you know, they thought that by his resignation, he was then cast into outer darkness. But he certainly wasn't, certainly sitting on an international satellite TV channel with his own programme.
Absolutely. And don't forget that the head of the civil service in Scotland is approved by the civil service in Westminster. And the head of the civil service in Scotland was obviously involved quite deeply, along with Nicola and others, in terms of orchestrating the campaign against Alex. And that, you know, and don't forget that not only did Alex win his case at the trial, he also won £500,000 in damages from the Scottish government for the action they took against him. And this latest case, which is going to go ahead, is going to seek the damages for the damages to his reputation by this. So there could well be that our friends in British intelligence have been involved as well. In fact, to be frank, it would be surprising if they weren't, because this is a major threat to the breakup of the British state. And guess what Scotland's got that England still needs? It's our so-called nuclear independent deterrent, which, of course, if you know the wars in Russia or Ukraine or indeed in the Middle East lead to tactical nuclear warfare, then the first place in Britain to be hit will be the nuclear bases in Faslane and the Clyde. And Glasgow might well suffer rather badly from that. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if British intelligence were not involved.
Okay, well, what about the RT programme? I mean, this was watched around the world, bizarrely.
Absolutely.
It was blocked in Britain.
I know. I used to appear on it, and I appeared on RT radio and so on. And the truth was, it was actually, Alex said, we had never had any interference from RT on what we did and what we made. But of course, it was blocked in the UK because, bit like Al Jazeera, which funnily enough seems to have disappeared from Freeview, or at least been relegated to number 251, where the reception is much more shaky. I have to watch it on YouTube to get clear reception from Al Jazeera these days. The truth is that the media in Britain are controlled by a small group of people, either who live here or live abroad, but in the interest of the ruling class in Britain, and that they want to exclude any contrary views. And even the so-called liberal papers like The Guardian are frankly pale imitations of what they used to be, and that they tend to reflect the prevailing view as well. So RT was seen as a threat. It was seen to be offering an alternative view, as is Al Jazeera. You know? So it had to be closed down because, of course, well, I mean, it's just like the Novichok case, which has raised its head again 6 years after the events, no doubt because it's something to do with the Russia phobia that's around at the present time. Though Craig Murray's blog is worth reading, of course, on that, who shows us absolute pack of nonsense from start to finish, the whole Novichok nonsense.
Okay, so Hugh, what was your last meeting with, when did you last see Alex?
Oh gosh, it was about 2 months ago. We had a national council meeting. I'm on the national council of Alba. And we'd had some internal problems and stuff like that. And I said to him, look, Alec, what I said to you when I joined Alba is I don't want to belong to just a small party that is run by you for your benefit. I want an open democratic party, which is an alternative to the SNP. And he said, Hugh, that's what we're going to get, which is why I joined. And I said, you know, but I'm putting my faith in you to resolve these problems. And he was very grateful and said, thank you very much. And I intend to do that. And he was in the process of doing that. We're due to have a national conference in November, in the middle of November. And of course, it will now be a very different national conference. But I've been speaking to Kenny, who is the acting leader, Kenny McCaskill, the acting leader. He was the deputy to Alec. And a very, very good man, Kenny, former Minister of Justice in Scotland. Old socialist, you know, really good politics, really good vows. And he's determined that the Alba will continue. I think that Alba could be part of the government of Scotland in 2026. There is a prospect there. I think Labour, which did well in the parliamentary elections in July, is already becoming very unpopular in Scotland because of what they're doing down south. And as we say in Scotland, they're just a branch office in Scotland. They're told what to do. So all 37 Labour MPs have voted to keep the two-child cap. They voted to abolish the winter fuel payments. And already three by-elections in councils in Scotland, they've lost all three. And the SNP have done well, and Alba have picked up votes. So I think by 2026, the Scottish parliamentary elections, Labour could be so unpopular that they will fail to win control, and that the SNP might be damaged by the court revelations, that Alba could pick up a substantial vote, and that between Alba, the SNP, and other independent supporting parties, we might yell, get a majority for independence. And then at that point, I think we should declare independence, never mind this referendum given, just declare it. You know, the 200 countries in the UN, 180 of them have gone independent without referendums. Wow. Referendums are an optional extra. When the country wants it, we'll have it.
And, so we're going to have
Alex's memory will live.
Checkpoints on the A1 and the M6, eh?
No. We'll have a free and open border like we do between Ireland and the UK. And we're going to rename the fourth road bridge as the Alex Salmond Bridge in memory of Alec and many other things. He was a giant of a man, a great man, and sadly will be lost. But as he said, the dream will continue. And
so what about, this is finally, what about, Alba aside, what about independence for Scotland? What do you see as the changes which will bring it about? I mean, I know you've said that you want to have a kind of universal declaration of independence sort of thing, but I mean, do you think we'll see it in our lifetime, genuine independence? And anyway, you know, you can imagine Scotland, like Ireland, becoming independent from the British Empire, and then going and joining up with Brussels and being, you know, having them as the bugbear, being dominated by them.
Well, Alba's position is that we should not rejoin the EU, that we should join EFTA, which, you know, gives us access to the single market of the EU, but is a, you know, much more control of our own affairs, and let the people of Scotland decide in future whether they want to rejoin the EU or not. You're quite right. I mean, I was in Ireland recently, amount of new office blocks down the Liffey, you know, it's a remarkably different country from my first went there in the 1960s. The truth is that actually Scotland could be that kind of country, but with a social democratic twist. Ireland's got more of a free market twist. Could be like Denmark. I spent a number of years in Denmark, had a Danish wife, you know, where the quality of public services is much higher, the inequality is much less, you know, where we don't spend lots of useless money on wars and so on. So Scotland could be different. I think it will happen, probably not in my lifetime. I'm 80. Maybe in your lifetime, Tony, you sound just like a youngster to me. what the demographics, as I say, the majority of Scotland's citizens under 55 are heavily in favour of independence. It's old folk like myself, we're a little more cautious and so on. And do you guess the thing about them, Tony? They're dying out. And I think Scotland will be independent. It may take another 10 or another 20 years, it'll happen. And I think Ireland will be united as well in the same time. And England will be left, maybe Wales will be independent by then, be left to become the offshore capital, the Singapore of Europe, which is what Keir Starmer seems to want it to be.
Yeah, all right. Okay, Hugh, how do people follow you, find you on social media?
Well, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter. I'm not terribly good on Twitter, I must admit, but I'm on Facebook, so they can follow me there. And I correspond regularly in the Scottish media, as I say, through Alba. But I don't do blogs because life's too short. I also edit the Edinburgh Music Review, which is an online music magazine which covers opera, classical music, folk music in Scotland and around the world. So that kind of keeps me busy. And I'm 80, Tony, so I'm entitled to have a little relaxation.
Yeah, you certainly are. Okay, Hugh Kirkett, thanks very much for joining us.
No problem.